We have special guests with us here this morning, and we have a number of special guests with us here this morning. But one in particular I'd like to introduce to you that's going to come up and give you a few words of wisdom. And that would be Undersecretary McKinney. Ted McKinney is the Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Affairs at USDA, and he leads the development and implementation of the department's trade policy, oversees and facilitates foreign market access, and promotes opportunities for U.S. agriculture throughout various trade programs in high-level governmental negotiations. In 2014, McKinney was appointed by then-Governor Mike Pence to serve as director of the Indiana State Department of Agriculture. McKinney grew up on a family grain and livestock farm in Tipton, Indiana, and was a 10-year 4-H member and an Indiana State FFA officer. Undersecretary, is that coat still fit?
Yes.
Yeah, good answer. He graduated from Purdue University with a BS degree in agricultural economics in 1981 and received the G.A. Ross Award as the outstanding senior male graduate. He and his wife, Julie, have 3 children and 4 grandchildren. So with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. Undersecretary McKinney to please come forward and give us his thoughts for this morning. So.
Thank you, Mr. President. Well, thank you, President Bednarski. It's good to see you, and it's good to be back in Michigan. How many Michiganders do we have in here, just so I know? Oh, my gosh, plenty of you. Well, this is like my second home, even though Indiana is absolutely my home. All my cousins lived in a suburb near Detroit. My uncle was an executive with Ford Motor Company, so many fond memories of being in Birmingham, Michigan. And then through my various work in the corporate private sector, how do you not find your way to Traverse City or Mackinac Island? Now other places we've been to, so thank you for hosting us. This is also first. I've been by Grand Rapids, but never in Grand Rapids. I've been to so many other cities in your fine state, so thanks for the opportunity to do that. I also want to say a special thank you in an odd sort of way. Thank you for your dress code. Now, I don't mind. I even like wearing a suit and tie. There's something about being professional, but boy, when I get a chance to lose the tie and go with a sport coat, it is a good day, and so I'm grateful for the little things, if this is so little, and I hope that you all are comfortable, because I am. Well, I want you to know that I am indebted to the Farm Bureau organization for many, 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 many years of friendships. When I was young and getting into leadership organizations, 4-H, like many of you, was my first, and then elected as a state FFA officer. One of the most meaningful training sessions that I ever attended was in Indianapolis. It was with all of the vocational youth organizations. So many of you might remember Office Education Association, FHA, DECA, VICA, and the list goes on. And there were others there as well. 4-H was there. And it was sponsored by none other than Indiana Farm Bureau. And it began a lifelong relationship with Indiana Farm Bureau from my perspective. And of course, our family farm has always been insured by Indiana Farm Bureau Insurance. Always very, very important. I make sure that when I talk to my twin brother who manages all the farms, that is still the case. He assures me, yes, it is. So whether it's sponsorships like you do with training, which I benefited from so many years ago, or the daily coverage of an accident that you never want to happen, but sometimes can happen on a farm like our own, I'm grateful for what you all do. And then I got to know many, many more of your states in my time, mostly doing state government relations for Dow AgroSciences, or even then a little bit continuing when I was doing industry affairs. And so that let me traipse really most of the eastern half of the U.S. So it was good to see my friend Tamara from Illinois, where I spent a lot of time and lived in Minnesota. We connected with some Minnesotans when I lived in Mankato. And always, always, it was a rich and meaningful relationship with Farm Bureau. And so today, I'm glad that you have this conference, and I'm thrilled to be able to speak to you because there's a lot going on in agriculture, not just trade. I would say trade could be, you know, the most prominent, the most visible out there, but there is just so much going on across the board. And I'd like to visit with you about some of those things with an emphasis on trade. I think the best way to do it is just to take a whirl around the world and talk about countries or regions of the world. And then I'm happy to take your follow-up questions by after I'm done, or I think there's some time later today in different sessions where if you miss one. But you're going to find I'm pretty transparent, or at least I try to be. So let's just start. Let's start with some low-hanging fruit. I'll start with Korea, or as they call it, CORUS, the free trade agreement with Korea. Many of us were worried about that, but I am pleased to say I think that is largely settled. Agriculture people in South Korea, agriculture people in the U.S. said, leave it alone, it's fine, don't open it up. And we didn't. And so all the things that most of agriculture is enjoying is continuing. And I said hello to a gentleman from Arkansas, and I want to thank the rice producers. The rice producers would have gained something had we opened that up. But they, I think, respectfully said, look, if it's going to open, sure, we'd like to talk about some more access. But don't open it up on our account. And the conclusion was that the president and U.S. Trade Representative's office did not. And so eat some rice, you know, over the next week as a thank you for those that could have gotten, may have gotten something more, but decided for the good of all of agriculture, let things lie. So I'm fairly comfortable with Korea, and I think we're going to continue to build a good relationship. I've made two trips there, not in just in this job, but in my former role as director of the State Department of Ag from Indiana. And I think there is a very strong common bond. And I say that beyond the fact that we've got a lot of our U.S. military, and we've got the DMZ, and we've got a lot of protection going on there. We wouldn't want that hung over our heads, and I don't think the U.S. hangs it over their head. They know it, and they're appreciative. And so that's why I'm so pleased and so comfortable that I think Korea is a good and growing market for many of the commodities, many of the food products that are sold, and I think some greater opportunities, particularly possibly for ethanol. So, South Korea, good friends. There's one thing that came out of the CORUS renegotiation, minus ag, and that is what we hope will be greater efficiency in and out of the ports. I don't know if our friends in South Korea are just nitpicky and dialed in to every last detail or what drives it, but oh my gosh, it can be difficult getting things in the ports there. It's painful. Our friends in the U.S. Embassy, and we have a very, very good Foreign Agricultural Administration staff there, are taking calls every day about one little thing or the other. And part of the CORUS renegotiation minus ag was, we are told, to fix some of those things. So it may not affect you farmers, but to whoever you sell to who also have to watch their bottom line, perhaps we'll get something good out of it, even for agriculture. So Korea. Let me jump now to NAFTA. Really small trade agreement, pretty inconsequential for the most part, right? For the media, I'm joking. Don't put that down. First, let's get the main things out of the way because they're important. Canada and Mexico are our very good friends, period. When you read the media accounts, absolutely there's to and fro. But it's a little like when I was growing up with my brothers. Did we get in fights periodically? Darn straight we did. But that didn't mean we don't love each other. And so I do believe we're going to settle NAFTA in one form or another. Now, I think ideally everybody would say, let's land this thing, all three holding hands, singing Kumbaya and going forward. It may also be a two-step approach. Do one country and then the other. But if you are possibly wondering whether opening up or modernizing, as the word we use, modernizing NAFTA was a good thing or a bad thing, I'll tell you that for right now, it's a darn good thing. Let me give you a couple of pieces of information. 25 years ago when NAFTA was formed, there was not a biotechnology chapter. We didn't have biotechnology. No biotech chapter. So we're just fortunate that Mexico and Canada, by and large, saw the world of biotechnology products. Soon it's gene editing or the CRISPR technologies. And we see those in the same light. But what we now have is a pretty darn good biotech chapter as part of the new NAFTA that will, I think, operate how we all trade amongst our three countries, and more importantly, I think sets a perfect ideal template for any other agreement that we, or frankly, any other countries might take on. That's a very, very good thing. That's an outstanding thing by itself. Let me take another chapter, the SPS, or sanitary, phytosanitary chapter. For years, I have long complained about the slippery slope of SPS. We've seen this excuse raised time and time and time again by many countries, and it's being used with greater frequency. Europe, those GMOs are unsafe. We cannot allow them in. We've got some study here that says we think they're unsafe. SPS. Hide behind SPS. Well, the SPS chapter's pretty darn good in NAFTA. It spells all that out. It tells you what your behaviors are and are not, what shall be and what cannot be. And so I think if we lift that up for our three countries alone, we have a real win. But as I said before, most of the time, countries around the world are looking to steal the best language, and many want to trade with the U.S., and they're going to see that chapter and say, well, if I'm going to deal with the U.S., which I want to do, that looks like the language we're going to start from. That, too, is a very, very, very good thing. So those two chapters alone tell me that modernizing NAFTA was a good thing. And plus, I mean, your own homes, do you not update your home once every few years, every 10 or 15 years? My wife's after me every year. I think every 25 years, a makeover is probably good. And so in the spirit of just re-examining the whole thing, I think 25 years is probably time. Now, I hope that this thing settles well. And I believe it will because NAFTA is too important to all three countries. I won't go through the statistics. You know them, particularly those of you here in Michigan with your proximity to the border. It's incredibly important. And the Canadians know that, and we know that. And similarly with Mexico, they know it, and we know it. I think we're going to get there more quickly. I think it's probably already very close with Mexico. My concern is with our good friends to the north. And I do mean good friends. Some of my best friends are Canadians. I don't know what's going on in the negotiation department, but it is not fair. So I tell our Canadians, do not lay frustrations with NAFTA at the feet of our president. You started Class 7 milk. You then decided to dump dry milk powder on the world market at half to two-thirds of world price. When I visit a dairy farmer in any of the states, particularly the northern states, I hear and I see and I feel their pain. And it's not all because of NAFTA or Class 7. But by golly, a great deal of it more recently is. So I think Secretary Perdue said it very well when he was on that wonderful exchange up to Prince Edward Island on his counterpart's farm, Mr. McCauley. He said, we're not here to dictate what you do and whether you have a managed milk supply or not. But if you're going to have a managed milk supply, manage it. Manage it. That doesn't mean you have the freedom to create these new classes every time you have a need and then take all your excess and dump it on the world market. Not fair. Not fair. So I would say to our friends in Canada, we would love an agreement with you, probably more than you might know. But please fix your Class 7 and allow some access as we allow you access to our market. And that's why I think the president has rightfully adjusted his messaging on what in the campaign was America First. What he's getting at is free, fair, and reciprocal trade. So in the seat that I'm sitting in, where I hear of all the hue and the cry and the frustration and the concern and some joys, I'm right there with you. But it's very difficult for me over the last 15 years in my policy days in the corporate world and as a director of ag to be complaining, sometimes long and hard, about unfair trade practices, sanitary, phytosanitary conditions, ignoring the rules of trade law. And then now, when I face the heat, say, I was only kidding then. So I'll just say thank you for your patience. I think the president does know absolutely where you stand. I know the vice president does because I've talked to him. He was my boss in Indiana. And I think just last week, I think several of the leaders of the U.S. ag industry, including your own president, Zippy Duvall, visited with the vice president. And we have a chance to visit with our colleagues at USTR, Commerce, State Department, Department of Defense, all of them. It's all sort of one happy family when it comes to addressing these major issues. Because trade involves more than ag. Ag is our thing, but trade, of course, deals with many, many, many more things. So as far as NAFTA goes, I think it will settle. If you have a good friend in Canada, slip them a text or a note and say, hey, would you encourage your government to settle in on this? Because I think that's where the holdup is. And I hope it gets settled. And I think it will. Let me go to Europe, including the UK. I also love Europe. All of my relatives came from there. Interestingly, back to my biotech example on Europe, some of my family left Ireland because of the potato famine, which I just bet could be solved with biotechnology. I mean, technologies like that, that's what they're for. So we love our friends. They are a very important trading partner when you total them. We must be very serious with them, and I think they with us. But this precautionary principle is bad and getting worse. Precautionary principle is misnomer. The better way I think they should say it is, we are accepting no risk anymore. No risk. The best example I can give you, and you know over the years, is the reluctance, the hesitancy, the rejection of biotech. And I think they've realized that might have been a mistake. We've had discussions on gene editing, and I don't know where they'll settle on this. But I hope they realize that this is not GMO. Gene editing, by the way, in case you wondered, is not genetic insertion. It does not meet the classification of GMO. So you ought to allow it and, by the way, embrace it. And, oh, by the way, encourage your universities and your companies to embrace it. They've lost so much ag technology over the last two decades, it'll curl your hair. Just because it's not a welcome area for technology development. So I think we have an opportunity to hit the reset button there. And I think things like gene editing or maybe a reexamination of biotechnology, now that we know, let's see, 1996 to present day, I think that's more than the 10 years I heard Greenpeace asking for to prove that it's safe, offers a great opportunity. But precautionary principles alive and well. The latest now is that they are, for those of you that know anything about risk, and I'll use pesticides as an example, you know that there's hazard. How problematic is the product you're using? And then there's exposure. Do you have any exposure to it? They're completely dropping exposure. Never mind whether you're going to be exposed to said chemical or not, it's all hazard. Well, essentially what that means is no residues. Not a part per quadrillion, not a part per billion, not a part per centillion. So what I'm afraid might happen is we're going to continue to open the door to their products. We're a fairly open country, always have been. And when we want to turn around and sell those same products back, We're going to get a nice handshake. Says, oh, gosh, so sorry. We found a defect. One part per quadrillion, which is like nothing. Out of Europe came the whole risk or assessment that Roundup might be a carcinogen. Garbage. One of the safest products ever known. So these are the kinds of issues that we're facing with our friends, and I do mean our friends in Europe. Because trade is a two-way street. I believe that. I want you to know when we go on these ag trade missions, yes, mostly we have folks that want to sell, but we take people that want to buy as well. Because last time I checked, if I export and you don't export, I win, you lose. And that's a pretty short relationship. So we have got to facilitate trade both ways. The UK Brexit offers a very interesting opportunity. Our friends in the UK are between a rock and a hard place. 80% or so of their trade is with Europe. As you might expect, that channel is not that wide, certainly not as wide as the water between the UK and the US. But part of Brexit was their incredible frustration with the mandates and the regulatory oversight of Brussels. So, to our friends in the UK, here's an opportunity to say we want some independence back and some of the choking regulations that you, our friends in Brussels, are imposing on us are too much. But they can't do that too easily and then lose the opportunity to trade. So I'm watching all the case studies I can get. The Economist is a terrific magazine I read. It's based in the UK. I'm reading it regularly to see how is Brexit going to go. I think it'd be fantastic if we had a free trade agreement. But I'll remind you, we are not allowed, and we play by the rules here, we're not allowed to visit on those topics until about March of next year. So that could offer an opportunity for Europe to say, my gosh, we have gone too far with things like the precautionary principle. You know, the UK used to be a wonderful net exporter of food. Boy, not now. Not now. Net importer of food. You know, when you can't have technologies like so many of you enjoy on your farms and ranches, where are you? And we're certainly not going to address this problem of 9 billion, 9.5 billion, whatever the number is, by 2050. Technology is what has brought us forward. Every time there's been the hue and the cry of some futurist that says, 15 years, we're going to run out of food. There's going to be more people in consumption than there is food available. And we've always in agriculture, we have made our way through that because of, first, your own hard work, but technology. So watch Europe and watch the UK with Brexit. Let me speak to Japan. Not our largest trading partner in any of the commodities, but boy, it's right there at second and third, and across the board, one of the finest, steadiest, most reliable trading partners that we have. It is a market that we want to stay very active in and grow. So I've spent several times over there. I don't miss an opportunity to go over to the Japanese embassy to interface with them. Many of them are fun when the Cherry Blossom Festival was going on with all those beautiful trees around the tidal basin and around the Japanese, or around the Jefferson Memorial. They had a cherry blossom reception. I don't miss that. I'll be at one in a couple of weeks. They are our very good friends. And so I understand why they were upset when we stepped out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They expended a lot of political capital, particularly with agriculture, to get TPP landed. But I also think they understand that elections come and go. You know, things change when there are elections. The president ran on a campaign that said it was not a good deal. He made the decision. He's standing by that. Now, I'll also say that a couple times he said, we ought to go rejoin TPP. We jumped all over that. So we don't know where that's going to land. But I do believe we will find at some point in time, and I hope it's sooner than later, a agreement of some sort, whether it's what the U.S. seems to be preferring now, which is a bilateral, a one-to-one, or if it's rejoining, probably with some modifications, the TPP. Let me give you a quick story. When I was in Japan, the Friday that I was there, I was leaving the next day, Ambassador Haggerty, a really great representative that we have in the U.S. ambassador there, hosted a big reception, and it was for the new Japanese ambassador coming to the U.S. There was a natural rotation, and it was time to change. First, he's fond of the U.S. He knows the U.S. well. His daughter is working, I think, in clothing up in New York City. Just a terrific guy, knows the Western cultures very, very well. And in front of us, what would be our Secretary of State was introducing the new ambassador. Now, it was Ambassador Haggerty, me, and a few others of us from the U.S. Embassy, but mostly it was a Japanese crowd. It was warm. It was effusive. And the Secretary of Foreign Affairs was having fun going down this long list of things the new ambassador needed to fix with the U.S. And by the way, we'd probably have an equally long list for them, but the point is, they were having fun with it right in front of us, and we can take a joke. And it reinforces just how strong the relationship is. And I do believe that President Trump and Prime Minister Abe have a good relationship and that we'll work that. I just hope it's sooner than later, because though Trans-Pacific Partnership or TPP-11 is not enacted yet, one at a time, different countries are approving that language, and as soon as they hit six, it's all intact. And that's when some of our competitors have access to a wonderful market that we have enjoyed, and will have much lower, in some cases, no tariffs. So time is of the issue. My sense, though, is we've got to finish NAFTA. That is the template the rest of the world is looking at. Finish NAFTA. Land this ship. Ship, S-H-I-P, land this ship, then we pivot and we can work with Japan and others. And by the way, never mind what you think about TPP. Most of us in ag were big fans of it. But it is true that you find the best deal for both parties when you do a bilateral. Now, it takes a lot longer. That's the downside of it. But you can dial in to a country's strengths and weaknesses, vice versa, two-way street, much better on a bilateral. And I think that is always what's driven our president, and I think is the case now. So I don't know whether it's going to be TPP-12 or whether it's going to be a bilateral, but we, by golly, need to get NAFTA settled, and then we can go. Let me get to China. We love our friends in China. How many of you are involved with the Soybean Association? Yep, 25, 30 years you all have dedicated to cultivate and develop that market. I was on one of those trips, I know that. And I love the Chinese people. And we've even got a wonderful relationship going with our friends in the new Ministry of Ag and Rural Affairs. They're going through a reorg of their government. So MARA, as opposed to MOA, is now the Ministry of Ag. The same with MOFCOM, Ministry of Commerce, which would be like our Commerce and USTR combined and others. We had a very good discussion 2 weeks ago. But at the core is that our friends in China have cheated for a very long time. And it's not just in ag. It transcends all the industries. And I think so far the president and others have not seen enough movement or commitment or evidence that that's going to change. Let me give you some stories. I don't know if you read Secretary Perdue's op-ed in the USA Today, the Des Moines Register, and others. He talks about 20 years ago, you know, a Chinese national being caught and prosecuted for stealing germplasm right out of a farmer's field. Oh, this is pervasive. This has happened more than once. It's happened with all the companies that are still in business. In my own case, when I worked in Indianapolis, a former colleague of mine in the laboratories is now in jail. I did not know him, but he was caught red-handed shipping new chemistries, new pesticide formulations straight to China. Not 20 miles away from the headquarters of that company, another good feed company. They decided that they're really good at feed, but they needed to get into next generation, so they got into some intellectual property, in this case, enzymes. And those of you in livestock know that enzymes, for most critters, helps with digestion. They pulled an employee right off the plane in his position. One-way ticket, by the way, to Beijing, are all the new formulations of enzymes that was their next generation of products. And this happens all the time. Now, I'd like to think, because I was serious when I said we have what I think is a good and growing relationship with our friends in China. But boy, that's bad acting. You would not do that to your neighbor, and I don't think they'd do that to you, or if they were doing it, it was going to be a short-lived relationship, right? And we've tolerated this for 15 years. Let me tell you what gets my gore. I remember as a kid walking soybean fields, taking cocklebur, jimson weed, sometimes velvet leaf out of soybean fields. How many of you walked soybean fields? I bet you haven't done very much of that since 1996 when Roundup came out, right? Last year, my brother had to hire a few kids to go out and take out some resistant weeds. And did you know that 8 of the 10 biotechnology traits that have been languishing in Beijing, when married up with their chemistry, could take care of those weeds? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. And they're not just taking them through the regulatory process. This is deliberate. The most recent one was submitted 48 months ago. The longest one, 78 months ago. It's deliberate. And we had that discussion with them. So we have got to see not unreasonable changes in behavior, but we've got to see reasonable changes in behavior. If you want to be a global player, be a global player, but follow the rules and be fair. So once again, I'm going to say thank you for your patience, because it's those kinds of things that we're all trying to resolve so that you don't look back, or your children or your grandchildren don't look back in 10, 20, 30, 40 years and say, if only we had put our foot down years ago. Now, we all know that time is not unlimited. I like to use the word, we don't have an unlimited runway to land this ship, meaning trade agreement with China. So I hope and pray, and I have shared that. I've followed up since I was in China with my colleagues. I'm not kidding when I said I think we have a real connection, and for the first time in a long time, they're showing with evidence things that they want to get accomplished that have just been burrs under our saddles, problems that we have faced. But proof is in the pudding. Wasn't it Ronald Reagan that said, trust but verify? Yeah, that's what we've got to do. We've seen this movie before many, many, many times. Do a deal, it withers. Do a deal, it withers. Do a deal, and it withers. So with respect to China, I would say buckle up, and I would even bring the shoulder straps over and click them twice, because this could be a bumpy ride. And I think it's all an attempt to right-size this relationship so that both countries can be successful. Certainly, we need their products and they need our products. And that's what my great hope is that we'll settle this thing and resolve the whole thing. So let me stop there, but with one additional point. If you want to get into any other countries, happy to take those as a Q&A. But let me just say that I am delighted with where the administration is going on so many things that were, back to my other analogy, burr under my saddle when I was working the farm with my brother or in the private sector. I think removing the uncertainty of waters of the U.S. is simply enormous. I don't know how a farmer would go into a farming year not knowing whether that puddle was a navigable water or not. I think the tax cuts have helped farmers. Regulatory reform is still running rampant. You should know that for every regulation that an agency like ours adds, used to be 2. You now have to remove 3 regulations. And we're not losing attention to the environment or safety of people. We're just trying to right-size what had been a runaway train for many, many years on regulations. So I'm grateful that we got that out of the way. And now I think we just need to settle in on some of these trade agreements. And I'm hoping that CORUS remains as it is. I think it will. I think NAFTA will land soon, it better, one way or the other, one step or two step. I think that lets us then turn to Japan. And so slowly but surely, I think we take those plates that are spinning on those rods, take them down one at a time safely, not broken, but take them down safely. And then I think we'll have more and more certainty for you all. That's something that I want. As for me, what gets me up every day is the same thing as when I was leading the Council for Biotech Information, which ultimately saved biotechnology in North America and other parts of the world. And that is, if we can add a little bit of margin to a farmer's bottom line, even 10 cents a bushel, 5 cents a bushel can make the difference these days. If we can add that through a trade deal or something that we've done in a negotiation, then I'll have at least done my service as a public servant, which I'm enjoying thoroughly, and that's what gets me going. Yes, sleep is overrated, but I don't have to tell a farmer that. You know that very, very well. So why don't we stop there, and I'm happy to take questions. I think there are white cards on your table if you want to send that in, or if you want the roving mic, somebody's got it. I don't know, maybe they should stand up. There we go. There's a roving mic, and we're happy to take your questions for at least a short period of time here. Thank you all very, very much. I have never, ever known Farm Bureau to be bashful. Anything is fair game. There we go.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. First of all, thank you for all of your travels and time away from family and all the hard work you're doing on the negotiations. If you were to have to prioritize one trade negotiation right now from the perspective of the administration, which one would it be? The Mexico, Canada, or China, or another? Just to
right.
Kind of give us a sense.
Right. Well, I'm going to answer it in two ways. They are all important, and I'm not kidding. I'm serious about that. It really is sort of it's all important. But by necessity, I think we have to land NAFTA first. And I would say right in tandem, China, you know, with the timing on these tariff implementations is equally as important. And I only raise NAFTA not to diminish the importance of Japan or any other country. It's just that most other countries are looking to see how NAFTA settles before they're going to be willing to negotiate. So that's why I answer it in that way. NAFTA countries and simultaneously China is how I would answer that. Mm-hmm. Good question. Yes, sir. Yes. Well, I don't know the answer, but I'd say we'd love to. I am not into the blame game, so let me just start with that. But we can't really move until we have that okay from the Congress and from the President. So until we have that, we're fairly restricted in what we can do. But we are doing some things that are allowable. For example, the Cuban ambassador to the U.S. was in my office yesterday. I had met him when he came to Indiana two years back. And there are some things that we can continue to work on. We're looking for you cattle ranchers, we're looking for a sample of their type of screwworm. We do not have screwworm. We don't have it north of Panama. So we need to get that so that the screwworm facility in Panama can find remedies just in case it finds its way into Central America, or God help us, into the U.S. So we're looking for that, and I think we'll get that. There is a protocol that's going on. Now, it's baby steps. It's not open your doors wide, trade flows freely, but it's something that we want and need to continue. And I think in many ways they are trying to resolve whatever that pulsating sound was that drove so many of our embassy people away. We don't know. They say they don't know what it was, but it's very real. And, you know, that kind of stuff cannot happen if you're going to have embassy people, including Foreign Ag Service people, who were there and did feel and were affected by that. So as we work through those kinds of things, we'll get there. I believe it's a matter of when, not if. But I can't give you the timeline. I wish I could. We'd love to have that market or get to it. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Under Secretary McKinnon, Brian wrote from Louisiana, as we go forward and try to negotiate and renegotiate these trade deals, it seems like many countries will agree on lots of things, but they don't apply to the agreements.
Right.
Are we looking at trying to add a layer or something to, like, especially countries like China and sometimes Mexico, that will agree to many things, but they don't really apply? Is there going to be a layer put down
Yes, I think so. Now, I want to make sure everyone knows it's the U.S. Trade Rep's office that does the negotiations on these things, and I have not been privy to all the language, but the answer is yes. But let me also back up and say, we have enforcement mechanisms now and have had for years that just have not been used. So you can put the toughest language in a NAFTA 2.0. You can put the toughest language in an agreement with China or Japan or whomever. But if there's not the political will to follow up and enforce the darn thing once you are operational, then what's the value of the agreement? So it's both. And we can say what we want about, you know, our president and, you know, how many plates are spinning out there, but he seems like he's a man of his word, and I think people around the world have taken notice of that. And that is helping ag, at least for right now, and I think it will continue to as well. So yeah, that language is there. And SPS language is the most important to me, because that's that soft underbelly where somebody can make allegations and then slip slide their way out without penalty. So yes is the answer to your question. Yes.
I know. How does this work through your office? How do you work with the local people like in Montana to work on these projects? And does it help in these trade negotiations to go with these kind of things?
Oh, my, yes. Well, the ways that our agency would work with you in this example, and my answer can apply to any of you, no matter your crop, no matter your business, is several fold, but let me hit some highlights. The first thing I would say is the Foreign Ag Service people, the Foreign Service officers representing ag in 93 embassies around the world, and those 93 cover about 170 plus countries, are some of the finest people I've ever met. And I knew them before I took this office, and my love and respect for them has only grown while I'm in this office. They are your eyes and ears. They have the insights. They have the relationships with government, with ports, with potential customers. So I have to start, if I say nothing else, the people in those embassies are outstanding. And they, of course, work closely with their ambassadors and the people from State Department, sometimes APHIS, our colleagues at USDA have a person or two there. So they're first. The second thing is we have some wonderful programs that help groups like yours. If you've ever heard of MAP and FMD funds, MAP is the Market Access Program. That's funds that Congress allots to my shop, my mission area, and we then allocate to, my gosh, I think every commodity group known to man and woman alike gets some of that, as they should. Soybeans, wheat, corn, dairy, fruits and vegetables. We're in Michigan, I can't miss tart cherries. The list goes on and on and on, and they use those monies to either fund somebody in that country, to collaborate with others on marketing programs. It is funding to do market promotion. And then FMD, Foreign Market Development Program, is a first cousin to that that's also very, very useful in that regard. I could go on and on in terms of programs that we have, but I would say the people and MAP and FMD funding would be the primary tools. Oh, part of MAP and FMD is that we are oftentimes on trade missions. That's why I'm gone so much. If you ever wondered whether an ag trade mission is worth you going on, and I've said this to the directors of the Department of Ag, and by the way, thank you for letting us borrow Jamie Clover Adams to come be Chief of Staff to Bill Northey. She is one of the finest people I have ever met, and bright, good night, she embarrasses me. So people like her, so directors of ag and mid to small size companies that want to come along on trade missions, and the commodity groups are always there as well. Rice is frequent, soybeans is frequent, grains council is frequent, wheat is frequent, the list goes on. Going on these trade missions really does put you belly to belly with a customer or belly to belly with governments, and we have a chance to resolve things. And, you know, I missed a point from my earlier talk. Let me add to that because it has to do with MAP and FMD. We took an ag trade mission, a full-blown trade mission, to Guatemala. It was really Guatemala in Guatemala City, but also Honduras and El Salvador came over. And I was thinking, oh, good. My philosophy in this area has been no stone unturned. We've got to go find every single market, no matter how large or small. But I thought, okay, this will be a nice piece of business, but, you know, it'll be a nice piece of business. All-time high record of business conducted was in Guatemala. There is business to be had out there in the world. And that tells me that, yes, we must take very good care of our NAFTA countries, of China, of Japan, of Korea, of Taiwan, and all our other major trading partners, but we cannot and shall not forget developing markets that in 5, 10, 20 years might be the next Japan, China, NAFTA country. And I think Guatemala was a very good representation of that. And all those people were there on MAP and FMD funding, which is a cost share program. It's not all government. We're protecting taxpayer dollars. Everybody has their hand on the burlap and everybody puts something in the kitty. And when they walk away, they're pretty darn happy. At least those that went to Guatemala were. Same goes for India, where we are investing. Still very difficult place to do business because they want to throw a tariff up every time, you know, a farmer, you know, raises his hand. I understand that. They're a developing country. We're going to be patient. But I do think in 15, 20 years, we're going to have a real wonderful relationship with India. Next question. What's the chance of getting back to do business with the Russians? Wow. Well, that's another one I'd strap all three on. I don't know. I've seen the best and I've seen the worst of our relationship with Russia. A good friend of our family was Earl Butts, who many of you might remember in those days saying, plant fence row to fence row. And remember the wheat sales that were there really to save their lives. I mean, you know, they've had two or three bad crops. But our friends in Russia are so up and down and yin and yang on their regulations. One moment poultry can come in, the next moment it can't come in. So there will always be some sales there, I think, as long as they allow it. But the reliability of that market, not unlike what we were talking about with China, is really something. And I think a lot of it comes with where are you on the world stage, where's the bravado, you know, all of that kind of thing. So I would have to say there will be a market there, but it's going to be very unpredictable for some time to come. The question was how much impact rests with the fact that they are willing to hurt their people. Well, you know, we all read the stories. I don't know if it's true or not. I will tell you more with China than Russia because I'm less familiar with Russia. I don't think it's quite so easy for a government just to say, take it for the premier, take it for the party. We're going to starve to make a point. China, when, I forget which of the premiers opened up China in a major way. It really began shortly after Nixon made that historic trip. I think it was 1972 or 3. Our friends in China, many, 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 not all by any stretch, but many enjoy a wonderful lifestyle now. And they don't want to go back. And so the government was very open with us as saying that social stability is very important to them. Now, I think they can push those boundaries, but starve, you peasants, starve is not what I think they are going to say. I don't think they are saying, and I don't think they can say it. So things have changed around the world as incomes have risen, and in particular with China. So, you know, this is not a one-sided issue. We're not the only ones that could lose out of this deal. That's why I think they really, really do want to have a deal and come to deal. At least I hope so. And it's just a matter of finding that equilibrium where everybody says, okay, we get something. Yep. One more question. Back in the back.
Tools in the trade negotiation toolbox. It appears that the administration is
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit and why the choice of tariffs as the primary negotiating tool?
Well, that's an excellent question that I don't know that I can answer. Let me try, but I'm not an insider. I would say it's quick. You know, it's something that can be brought on very quickly. The president believes, as you all read, that trade deficits are a major issue, and so I'll tariff you. That's a way to bring trade back into equilibrium. But I would tell you, we agree that there are many, many tools, and we find ways to introduce those ideas time and time again. Sometimes it's a quiet whisper in one's ear. Sometimes our megaphone is on loud. We're looking for a turbocharger to put on it to make it louder. So we're finding all ways to communicate the differences. I also think that we in ag have some special lessons, because it's not infrequent that agriculture or food and ag is the first roundhouse hook in response to things like that, whether it's tariffs or anything else. It's just easy. Look at the map, you know, and you can see where you need to target your penalties. And so I think if we can keep looking at the different options and find out that maybe tariffs aren't the only one, but they certainly seem to be the ones right now. Now, the tariffs, you have to segment, by the way. The 301 tariffs, which is directed only at China, is about investment misbehavior. It's the examples I gave you. It's examples like companies that want to do business there are told in China for China. You want to do business here? You better invest in China. Gotcha. I'm going to invest in China. Then you find out at the end, in order to invest in our companies, you got to turn over a lot of your intellectual property. So some of those kinds of nefarious actions are not successful, and that's why tariff can be a quick thing. I'm not here to judge whether tariffs are right or wrong. I would agree with you, those many tools, and we're offering up some of those as ideas. We've got to use every tool in the toolbox, sir. Thank you, Mr. Bednarski. This has been a great opportunity, and we'll be here till about 3 o'clock with a couple other events with you. So thank you.
Undersecretary, thank you.
Appreciate it very much.
Thank you again, Undersecretary, for giving us your insight of what you see in the job that you hold and the position you hold and your everyday activities and looking out for agriculture. It's nice to have a person there with the ag background and the knowledge to be able to understand what we are going through, what we're talking about, and the many different commodities we grow throughout this country. So with that, thank you very much for your work. Well done. And we have a small token of appreciation from Michigan for you. So there you go.
Thank you very much.
There we go.
Hey, thanks very much.
Thank you. Okay, with that, we would like to get everyone sent off to their respective commodity meetings. So with that, we're going to kind of wrap up the general session here. So first of all, I would like to say thank you to everyone for joining our National Commodity Summit and taking part in this event. And like I said, if you could find your way back to your respective rooms, the ones you were in yesterday should be the same. And we will continue on with the further discussions. Also, there are evaluation forms in the back of the room. Please, if you would, grab one of those and give us your thoughts, and we will try to improve on this in the next one that we have. So with that, safe travels to everyone, and we will look forward to hearing your results when we're finished. So thank you very much.